This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Mysteries, hoaxes, folklore, conspiracy, and pseudo-history. Topics sometimes avoided by historians who don't want to normalize nonsense or draw attention to the blind spots in our knowledge of the past. But these are some of our most intriguing tales. The Lost Colony of Roanoke, The Man in the Iron Mask, The Princes in the Tower, The Battle of Los Angeles, The Turin Shroud. Stories like these, fraught with ambiguities and falsehoods and suggesting alternate views of history, not only entertain but also teach us to view the past and the present with a critical eye. Join me, Nathaniel Lloyd, as I delve into these stories on my podcast, Historical Blindness, and shine a light in the darker corners of the past. New episodes every other Tuesday, available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and most podcast apps.
Boy, oh boy, Marie.
I know, right?
It's been a day. It's been a day.
It's been a day. What a day it has been.
Tell you what.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. So we have to stop everything. We have to stop everything that we had planned on our books to discuss and record. We had to, like, literally take days off from work just because we have to figure out what the hell is going on with the new Cats trailer. The new musical Cats. And we have to discuss it. I'm sorry if this is too on point for some people. This is too much of a hot take. But I saw it and I literally was like, oh my God, what does Cox think of this? Have you seen this yet?
It's pretty scary, right? As somebody who enjoys the creature, the Cats, right?
We love cats.
Love cats. Big cat fans of this podcast.
We are people who love cats.
Listen, I'm a fan. I'm definitely a fan of art forms that are way past their prime, like musicals too.
I'm kind of into it,
right? Like, it's kind of fun. I'm kind of into it, but all of it is weird. The whole thing about it is weird. The original show is freaking weird. And
the original show's a little strange too.
It's all weird. Yeah. It's all terrifying and weird, Marie.
Yeah. So if you haven't seen it yet and you have no idea what all of a sudden we've gone off the deep end about this time, it is a remake of a Broadway musical from the 1980s called Cats. And it is being remade by Tom Hooper, who was the director who brought us, The King's Speech and a few other pretty well-received films. And he's adapting it into a feature-length film. And they just, I believe it was at Comic-Con or coinciding with Comic-Con, that they premiered the trailer. And it has a number of very prominent musicians and actors and Stringer Bells in it even. And the scary thing about it is you can tell that they've thrown money at it. They have a huge amount of talented people singing and performing in it. And it is the most terrifying thing on the face of the planet because of how they portray the cats in the actual trailer itself.
It's not good.
It's not good. And they even went so far as to release like this, the making of, you know, in a little snippet trailer as well, when they're talking about sort of, so here's, you know, they have all the talented people like Judi Dench and Taylor Swift and Jennifer Hudson talking about, oh my God, it's a seminal musical. It's like, I fell in love with it when I was a child, and it's such an honor to be bringing it to, you know, to the masses. And I am so like, there's such this almost religiosity around it. And then they start to, then they show them in, so you're looking at there and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, I know her. That's Jennifer, oh, that's Dame Judi Dench. Yeah, that's, you know, that's M from a Bond. And then all of a sudden you see her in like, in her digitalized cat form. And it is like the most horrific thing on the face of the planet. And you literally, like, you literally feel revulsion. And there's actually, there's like, scientific reasons for why people have a certain reaction to it, because some people are like, yeah, it seems all right, seems like it might be good popcorn film, and then there's others that are like, this is the creepiest thing I've ever seen, and they need to abolish this.
So this episode we are going to talk about the uncanny valley of virtual reality generally, and just cats. Just why cats.
Why cats?
All right, Marie. So, the little bit of research I did for this. So, for listeners that do not know, again, we you gotta watch the trailer, right?
You do have to watch the trailer.
You gotta watch the trailer. And it's important also to know. So this whole thing started off as like a fever dream of Andrew Lloyd Webber's. What's interesting actually is he actually started working on something like this when he was a kid, because he actually had the book Cats itself. The play is based on a book of poems by T.S. Eliot called Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, which have a bunch of like weird poems, like, you know, the Song of the Jellicles, the Rum Tum Tugger, Growl Tiger's Last Stand, Gus the Theater Cat, McCavity the Mystery Cat, Skimble Shanks, right? All this other stuff. And so interestingly, it was all of that random stuff. Andrew Lloyd Webber was like, well, what if we make a play where there's a group of these cats and they all live in like, I don't even remember if in the original play they live in like the human world or if they live in a cat's human world, but essentially it's like a weird dystopia where once a year all of the cats get together, and the cats are called Jellicles. That's like their gang, right? So you got the Jellicles, you got the Bloods, you got the Crips. Yeah. And then the Jellicles get together and they have essentially like a dance off to decide which cat is the most deserving to ascend through the heavy side layer, which is their version of like ascending to Nirvana or heaven.
Yes. But let's back up by saying that the 80s was the perfect time for Andrew Lloyd Webber to put this out, right? Because it's like he took it from something that is not a linear story to begin with. And then he puts it, He tests it in London, and then he rolls it out on Broadway, and people kind of go nuts for it. And it's like it makes no sense, but there is a prestige to getting tickets. It's considered like, if you can get tickets to go see Cats, it's considered it was more than Hamilton. It was like, it was at least in like Hamilton's like really actually good, makes sense, and it has a story to it. Cats is like, again, like, I think people went to go see it just for the prestige of going to see it, but they didn't really understand what the hell it was about, because it wasn't about anything. What is a Jellicle cat? There's no, the only plot is they come together for a dance off and one of them gets to ascend. And I think that's it.
Yeah, pretty much. And so the play is in two acts. The first act is when cats are maddened by the midnight dance. And act two is, why will the summer day delay? When will time flow away? Proving that there is no limit to the amount of cocaine Andrew Lloyd Webber can do. The terrifying.
Dude,
terrifying.
It made bank.
It did. Here's the thing, right?
It made bank.
It made crazy bank. It made so much damn money when it first released. It's like it was the longest running Broadway production for a huge amount of years, right? It premiered 38 years ago. It's been going. Yes. It was 21 years the first run. It's been going, you know, off and on since then too, which is just wild as hell. It's just like, and it had a direct-to-TV movie, which is why I know of it best, because I was tortured with it as a child quite frequently. So,
oh my God.
And here's the thing, right? So that's kind of the background, right? And so, you know, one day Hollywood executives were in a room meeting with Satan, and Satan said to them, hey, let's remake Cats. Right? Like, it worked
great. They had just gotten done with The Lion King, and they were like, what could freak people out more than The Lion King?
Right, what else can
we do? Did we do Aladdin? Yeah, we got Aladdin. You know, we're done with, we got to let Disney go for a little bit. People are starting to get onto us about Disney. What about Cats?
Yeah, and so this actually follows, so Tom Hooper, what's interesting with Tom Hooper, Marie, in some ways is, I feel like he had a pretty, like, so he did Elizabeth the First, he did the John Adams series, right? He's part of, like you said, the King's Speech. Then he did Les Miserables, and then Cats, and the Danish Girl, too. He also did the Danish Girl, right?
Okay, so everything up to Les Mis, perfectly fine, perfectly good, right? I mean, like, I feel like the King's Speech got a little hyped, and it should have been more like an HBO or like a Netflix. Like, kind of, you know, it wasn't as big as what, but all perfectly good, well acted, interesting films. And then, you know, again, Les Mis, I'm not a big Les Mis fan. Les Mis is huge, and I know people get really worked up about it. You know, it doesn't, but anyways, but I mean, again, like, it's still at least it was something, but this, yes, I'm sorry, keep going.
No, So that's how that happened. And so then they kind of grabbed together like a random, so they grabbed together a grab bag list of random actors and actresses for this movie. Some of whom are truly talented. Shocking. It is truly shocking that they could get Judi Dench to be in this movie.
Yes. Well, they got James Corden. James Corden is a huge vocal talent. Jennifer Hudson, huge vocal talent. Taylor Swift, arguable.
Right? Yeah.
So good, bad, and different. She's still very well known for singing. Stringer Bell, right? They got Idris.
Yeah, Idris. So here's the character list. So Francesca Hayward is Victoria, who she's a
ballerina.
She's a ballerina soon to be ex-actress.
She is like a prima ballerina, so she's very well known in the arts.
Yes.
So this is sort of a questionable move.
Yeah. So Judi Dench as old Deuteronomy. Yeah. Yep. So she was the leader, like the head gang member. She's the Suge Knight of the Jellicles. Then you have Jennifer Hudson as Grizzabella, who appears to be a cat made of garbage. Taylor Swift as Bombalorina, which I don't know. Idris Elba as McCavity,
McCavity, the magical cat.
Right? I don't even understand how they got Idris Elba to be in this. Jason Derulo as Rum Tum Tugger. That one makes a little bit more sense that he'd be in this movie. Lori Davidson as Mr. Mistopheles. This is a badass name.
Mr. Mistopheles,
James Corden as Bustopher Jones, which is a little bit of a personal attack on me. I don't appreciate it. And then Rebel Wilson as Jenny and Dots. And I don't know.
I love Rebel Wilson. Like, again, like, people that have, you know, you've seen them sing before, totally respectable in a lot of circumstances. And then you're like, well, this isn't, you know, and again, like, if you didn't know anything about it or if you hadn't seen anything, And you were like, oh, they're getting together. They're doing singing. I saw La La Land. I thought it was all right. I can hang with that. And then you see the video. And I think the thing about the video and about the trailer and what the entire, like, God only knows how long this movie's going to be, like 2 hours plus of this, is they don't look like cats. They are covered with like this digitalized fur, but they have human faces. And they have, sometimes they walk on two legs, sometimes they walk on four legs. They have like tails that move, but they're in human form. And then they have human hands and human feet, so they don't have paws. So it invokes, like, as soon as it dropped, people on Twitter just basically freaked out. And there were people that liked it and were excited. And then everyone else was like, this is the creepiest S I've ever seen in my entire life. And one of the reasons for that is because it's like a scientific, or relatively scientific response to, called, it was coined by Freud in 1919, called the uncanny, or the unheimlich. I think I'm saying that right, which basically is someone's reaction to something that should be familiar. So you are observing or seeing something that hypothetically should be very familiar to you. It's the image of another person. It's the image of something that you grew up with, or something that is, like I said, very familiar to you. And instead of having an endearing or a bonding sensation to it, it becomes repulsive. And you don't exactly know why. There's something about it that is just that much off from what your expectation of a natural form should be, that it repulses you. And to me, that is like exactly what happened with this whole thing with the cats. It also happened recently with the trailer that they dropped for Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yes. It very much so happened with Sonic the Hedgehog too. So, like Marie said, it's like a physical revulsion or response to something being just slightly off enough to make you uncomfortable, you know? Yes. So the way that I've actually always understood it is with my own personal nightmare of a doppelganger, right? Mm-hmm. That's always been like, it's that thing. It's similar to why, say, like the image of, say, like Slender Man is so scary. Mm-hmm. Is it's this thing that looks humanoid, but it's just it's a little off, right? Same thing with aliens too. Mm-hmm. They're like humans, but their hands are a little too long, or the limbs are a little too spindly, or the head's a little too big, right? It's just off enough that it makes you uncomfortable. And it's a really hard, I feel like it's something that horror movies have had a hard time portraying really well. Yet our musical theater companies have been nailing it for decades.
Because it's something that happens in your unconscious. So if you are consciously trying to invoke it, it doesn't work as well, right? Because the root of the word is the German for home. Or home, some about the home, homely, in the respect of the hearth and home, right? And it's cozy, it's intimate, it's safe, right? And so the inversion of that is something that should be all of those things, but is the exact mirror opposite. So you see that again with like the doppelgangers, the idea of the other, the idea of like dolls, puppetry, things that along that line that again, like, it's not consciously, like if somebody starts off to consciously try and invoke this, you're so used to it now that you kind of blows right over you and you can kind of get past it. It's when it comes up in sort of more everyday things or in everyday examples, or when it's not supposed to be creepy and it comes across as super creepy.
Yeah.
Like with these cats.
Yeah. So the original,
so creepy.
The original word, or the reason that we know it, is from the Uncanny Valley, which actually is coming from a mixture of a term that was identified by a robotics professor Masahiro Mori as Bukimi no Tani Gensho, right? In the 70s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like,
which is so cool.
It's so interesting, right? So it's kind of like, it's one of those things where philosophy and, or psychology, I guess I would say, and and science kind of catch up to each other, you know?
Yeah.
And it's,
it's especially about like robots, right? And our reaction to robotic and especially like animation in robotics too.
Yeah. So
especially fascinating.
What's interesting, right? Is that it, what's the word? It becomes, so his hypothesis was this idea that there is a point. So imagine you have a robot and, you know, right? Like, let's say your Google Home. Your Google Home right now looks like a little annoying cylinder that will occasionally help you with the weather, but ultimately is just, you know, mishearing your Spotify requests. So
it's just, it's a little bloop that sits on your desk, right?
Right,
and
right.
You don't identify it with anything except it being round. It's sort of cute. Maybe it's just like a little bloop or something.
Right. So it doesn't have any physical features, though. It has no human like appearance or anything. So it's just, it's just a machine. But imagine you put a little face on the Google Home, right? Yes. Or imagine you build it to have a little body, right? Now it's a little Google Home guy that stands there and hangs out with you, right? As those human traits increase, your empathy with the robot will increase, right? And so the more and more human it gets, the more and more you will feel empathetic towards this thing. But then there is a certain point upon which your empathy turns to revulsion. And so that point,
very quickly.
Yes, yeah. Really quickly, right? So that point between where the thing is not human enough, or it's too human, that you feel revulsion, to then the theoretical regaining of empathy towards a human character or something. That is the uncanny valley, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the dip, like, again, you empathize, you sympathize, you see your reflection in it some way, in that it still is homey, or you can still, again, like, there's still something appealing about it. Like, again, if it's cute, or if it's, like, they did this whole study about Volkswagen and how Volkswagen modeled a certain year of car, the front, the grill and the headlights on the car was, I can't remember what the year was, but they did a big study on it, and it was to mimic either a child, baby, or a animal's face, right? So it has the big eyes and it's looking up at you and it looks sort of helpless. And that was one of their selling points. That was something that they built into the car. And built into the dynamics of how the car looked. And it sold really well and people really liked it. And so when they came out with the next iteration, it didn't do as well because there wasn't this sort of appeal, or this sort of, I don't know, this subconscious sort of like want to take care of it, or to like it because it was appealing. But then all of a sudden you can see when something gets a bit too human and a bit too close to being a replicant of a human, then all of a sudden it becomes revulsion. And this happens especially, like, the drop or the valley portion happens especially if it starts to move, if it becomes the animatronic or it moves. Because if it's just sitting still, again, you're psychologically, you can sort of put it in the right context that it's not a living thing. If it starts to move, your revulsion goes up because it's beginning to mimic your behavior in more than one way, right? And it's actually becoming a physical thing, which I think is kind of creepy. And I think, like, I was trying to think of like a good recent example of this, and I think it's from the movie Annihilation, that was by the book, and it's at the very end where, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it, but whatever the thing is that's taken over the Southern Reach, Area X, starts to mimic the movement and the look of Natalie Portman, who is the star in it. And it is very like uncanny. It starts off as something that seems very, like, not very threatening, and then all of a sudden you're like, ugh, and you don't really know why, and it's because it's starting to move. And you're like, ugh.
Interesting.
And again, that's like They hit on that super well for cats. Because these cats are like singing and dancing. And you're like, there's one scene where it's like, you can't even really figure out the scale because they're like, they're sitting at this human table and they seem smaller and the doors are really big. And so you're like, well, are they the size of normal cats? Why do they still have hands? And then all of a sudden they're out singing and dancing and some of them are wearing clothes and some of them aren't wearing clothes. And you're like, why are they still wearing clothes? And then they have cat-like ears, but they have normal human faces.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah,
and
so
you're like, ew.
Yeah,
why is that?
It's interesting, right? There's a couple of different reasons why we think that the uncanny valley exists, like physically, right? Because it seems like such a weird thing. Again, though, yeah. This is part of like something of a just so story, right? Because it's like, to me, a lot of these seem like we are putting. Putting like sensible document or not sensible documentation, but almost like we're making something that we feel fit into biological or evolutionary terms when really it's just maybe it's just a weird thing. We just don't like robots. Do you know what I mean?
Two realistic humanoid robots and zombies.
Yeah, but so
zombies is also the bottom of the uncanny valley.
So there's a couple of these here, right? There's the idea of mate selection, the idea of mortality, salience. Pathogenic avoidance. It's a paradox of our human identity, a violation of our norms. It changes our religious definitions. It gives us a threat. So all of these are basically all those same kind of things, right? And then the other one is too conflicting perceptual cues, which is probably the least of the ridiculous. I'd say it's the least ridiculous of them all generally. But Marie, do we want to go through each of these and maybe try to explain what they mean?
Yeah, sure. Heck yeah.
So mate selection, right? Mm-hmm. This is like the general just so stupid evolutionary biology one or biology, you know, where people say like, well, why do guys play guitar? And it's like, because playing guitar is like good for you getting mates, man. And so then like that's evolutionary advantageous. And so that's why playing guitar is like evolution, man. And it's like, oh my God, take off the beret. Shut up. You don't know any, you know, you're a freshman in philosophy. Stop it. Stop it, Carl.
Stop it, Dave.
So
nobody's interested.
The essential idea here is that, and this is similar to the other one, which is, what's the word? Similar to the pathogenic avoidance one. Essentially what it's saying is that you are looking at something that is your brain, like you are seeing something. That is supposed to be human and healthy and normal. Right. So you expect it to look a certain way.
It's not.
Right. And your brain is seeing a monster. And so your brain is like, get away from it. Right. Like run.
It's having some reaction, like the mate selection. You're seeing something and biologically, you know, it is not your species. Right.
Right.
There's something in it that you're like, this isn't good. And it's a threat. It's almost like, again, it like starts to trigger the fight or flight response, but it doesn't really even go that far because it's mimicking you, right? It's as close to human as you can get, and yet you're still like, ew, like this isn't an appropriate mate. This isn't an appropriate biological evolutionary pattern.
Right. And so it's actually part of I think probably the most interesting part of this argument is it is similar to the revulsion you feel when looking at a currently deceased corpse or someone who is diseased, someone who's in like a hospital bed, right? Who's very, very ill, who's clearly dying.
Right. Which is the pathogen, right?
Right.
Like you are, you are triggered and it's the fight or flight to keep away from it.
Right. There appears to be something intrinsic in our biology that causes us to feel revulsion at the idea of like banging a corpse, right? And so it's that revulsion that you you feel in the Uncanny Valley, because it's your body, it's your mind essentially saying, like,
your body saying, don't bang that
corpse. Right, like, don't bang the Taylor Swift cat's monster thing. It's not going to work out the way you think. You know,
it's not even human. Yeah. That's the thing that is very, like, they're just super creepy.
See, but you know what?
Their tails are really creepy. See, but, go ahead.
I was going to say, all these arguments, though, get, like, super close to eugenics, right? Because it's like, you know.
What do you mean? You think?
Yeah, it's like.
Like, how?
This is the same. Because, so. Is it?
Oh, you and eugenics.
Is it natural then? If the uncanny valley is a natural expression of a biological drive,
right,
that we can't control, right?
Then I don't think it's necessarily all biological. I think it's psychological.
It is psychological to some extent.
Psychological reaction.
But still, we're saying that it is because. So that's the thing, though. That's the point where the argument turns. Is it that our psychology has been molded by our society so that because society says banging a corpse is wrong, we feel revulsion at the idea? Or is it the other way, that biologically banging a corpse would be bad for us evolutionarily or as a species, and so therefore our society has morphed to mimic that in like a societal meme and in a norm? Right.
I would argue, because you're going for the extreme of like corpses again, like corpses and zombies are like the total bottom of the valley. I think it's psychological in that it is the representation of self and I'm more about like the identity of self, not so much eugenics, but like when I look in the mirror, I see what I am. You become used to seeing yourself and used to seeing yourself in, you know, move, used to seeing yourself in scope and sort of in context. The uncanny is when you see something that should have those same traits, that should have that same likeness. Likeness is a really bad term for it, because it's not just the physical likeness, but it's the psychological likeness. Like if I'm looking at something and, you know, you can, there's again, like there is a attachment because it is safe. It's known. It's the canny, right? It's not like the uncanny, because the uncanny is again, the thing that is the repulsion from that. So it's like, I think it's about self-identity.
So I was going to say, what Marie is hinting at is a way to get away from that.
And it's not eugenics.
Right. It's a way to get away from that kind of rhetorically questionable argument I just made, which is the idea that it is not.
Which was awesome.
Right. Which is that it is not linked to our biology necessarily. Instead, what it is that we as humans can and must recognize other moral beings that are deserving of empathy and respect, right? And Marie, if I'm getting your argument wrong, correct me. But essentially, it's the idea that, like, I know when I look at another person, I can recognize that they have a consciousness, that they are that they have feelings and will have emotions and will be hurt by things that I can say or do, and so therefore there is a kind of a mutual respect, or a recognition rather, that there is another consciousness there, and so they are deserving of my empathy. On the other hand, when looking at, say, a robot that
marionette.
Well, yeah, exactly. When looking at a robot that appears to be human, psychologically, I want to give that thing empathy, but it is not deserving of empathy necessarily, because it's not a consciousness, right? And so it brings up all these uncomfortable questions about, first off, what does it mean to be deserving of empathy, right? Can you make the argument?
Empathy might be strong. Empathy, again, like, I don't even know if it's so much as empathy as it is like identity, right? Because empathy means that you have the ability to sympathize or to empathize with something else. I think it's almost more of like identity, and how do I build and how do I construct my own identity?
Okay.
Which will lead to empathy, but it's almost like I look in a mirror, I can visually identify myself. That's me in the mirror. I can understand sort of myself in context. If I'm out in the world, I may not have that type of reflection except in other people to realize, again, more, it's almost like more myopic, but it's more like my identity exists in me. I can see something that's another human. It's different, but I can also recognize they have their own identity. I think the thing with the uncanny valley is when you see something and you don't get that immediate read. It could be empathy, but it also could just be the mirror existence of self.
I get what you're saying. Okay, so right? That's another. That's actually, I think, I get what you're saying there. I think that kind of leads into, or at least is similar to the idea of the mortal or mortality salience point, which is that seeing something that is uncanny. Right. Mm-hmm. Like these characters mm-hmm. from Cats or an Android or something makes you as a person question yourself and the things that you believe about yourself in a way that makes you uncomfortable. Right.
Well, and that uncomfort becomes revulsion because Freud would argue you don't want to face those things. Right. So you turn them off immediately. And by turning them off, you are revulsed by the other.
Yeah, so some of the examples they actually give, some of the examples that are often given for this are things like, you know, a robot that looks like a human may represent a existential threat to you because it may represent you being replaced, right? You might be able to be as good as a human, but you will never be able to be as good at your job as a robot. Right. You'll never be as fast as a robot or whatever. Right. So it elicits this uncomfortableness. At the same time, too, it elicits feelings of like, you know, well, if they can build a robot if they can build a robot that looks just like a human, then how can I ever know who's a human? And how can I know that I'm not just a meat machine? Right. Like, seriously, though.
And now we're down the rabbit hole. Yeah. But the interesting thing is, so in robotics, in sort of like the robot arm is not as peaked in the uncanny valley, right? So a robotic arm that is like in an assembly line arm does not invoke a threat, right? It's more like you were saying, it's got to be more the likeliness or the representation of a human.
Honestly, right? I think
the face, the eyes.
I was going to say, I honestly think it's walking. I think walking is the thing that does it.
Usually when it starts to move. So it's it's definitely when it starts to move, it drops. I was looking at a graph on it, and it is kind of cool because I never really understood where Uncanny Valley came from until starting to study this philosopher, this robotics professor. And it's sort of like, can you imagine being like, so you've dedicated yourself to a science. All right, Chris. So you're all like, I am a doctor of a science. And then all of a sudden it starts to creep you out a little bit. Right? you're like, God, I really feel like I don't want to be in the room having this, whatever it is, chemical look at me. I don't want to be in the same room as it. Like, I don't even want to talk about it with other people. But it's sort of like, that must be really hard because you've dedicated your life to something that all of a sudden psychologically is beginning to trip you out. I feel bad for the director, Hooper, man. He must be like, oh, God.
It's also one of those weird things, I think, where can you imagine being the one person in your friend group who isn't weirded out by the Cats trailer? Do you know what I mean? Like, can you imagine? I mean,
who do you think ours is? There's probably somebody out there who's like, I thought it was cool.
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, it's it's one of those things. It's one of those things that's kind of what's the word? It's, we're talking about it as if it is this universal human emotion of revulsion at this thing. And so, like, what does it mean what does it mean if you don't feel that revulsion, right? It's another one of those uncomfortable things that the Uncanny Valley kind of represents, right? It's like,
yes.
You ever see that documentary? It got turned into that movie, Lars and the Real Girl.
Yes.
Where it's about these people that live with lifelike sex dolls.
Oh my God.
Right? And like they dress them up, God. They take them to the movie. Those things are heavy. Those things are like 300 pounds. You know what I mean?
I didn't I've never picked one up.
Oh my God.
They're like, I had no idea.
I've never picked one up either, Marie. The way to throw shade. Thanks a lot. yeah, mine is
you
very
walked right into that.
Model.
You're like, do you know that they are very heavy? And I'm like, no, I had no idea. Please
and they're
go
so
on.
Hard to they're so hard to clean, and the wigs are expensive, and it's ridiculous.
The upkeep, and they are always talking. She's always on my ear about something.
She's always talking.
She wants this handbag, these new shoes, and you're like,
you won't shut up. it's one of those situations where. You know, even when people have uncomfortable, and I think another example of this is sort of the anthropomorphizing of things like, say, fursuits, right? It creates this uncomfortable link. And it's honestly, it's partially why I think, what's the word? Like getting into even more deeper, odd territory here, like fetishes, right? Why?
But fetishes, I don't know. I think the uncanny, I think it's, don't know if it's, I don't know. I don't know.
Think,
that's a good question.
I think it's almost like the reverse of a fetish, right? It's, there are undoubtedly people out there who would rather be with a robot than with a human. There are undoubtedly those people, right? And that's for different reasons, right? Whatever.
Yes.
But I would also say that as the uncanny valley, it elicits an uncomfortable response to us. But I bet that there are people out there whose wires have gotten crossed somehow, you know, and not to say that there's anything good or bad about that, whatever, for some reason, their upbringing, their personality type, their whatever has led them to actually, instead of feeling the revulsion to the uncanny valley, they feel the opposite, right? So, you know, I think it's a very similar.
Or even nothing. Nobody see they see it. Like, I think that that's almost stranger. Like, if you have zero reaction to it and you're like, yeah, it seems pretty normal.
Right.
Yeah, you know, one way or the other on it. Because then it's like, I feel like, again, the reason you have a reaction like that, either good or bad, is so your mind is telling you to take an action, which is, I think, a biological response, right? One way or the other, it's like you will. I am horrified by the Cats movie. I'm not going to go see it. For some reason, it scares me, right? Which comes from some sort of like, I have to protect myself from this. But if you're sort of like, yeah, it seems fine. Seems okay. I'm not one way or the other. Then you have no bearing. You have no guide for any of that stuff, which to me is almost more scary.
See, but I also think though that it is similar to, what's the word? I think it's also though similar to, I'll give you an example, right? Before the internet, right? Before like TV cameras and everything else and whatever, you know, there used to be freak shows, right? At carnivals and things and whatever.
Yes.
And so people would go to kind of get this same feeling. I would argue to, in some cases, get this same feeling from the people that were at these shows. And in many cases, these were people that were being, exploited. It's a hard thing, I think, to make the case that they were being, in some cases, they were being exploited. Let's leave it at that.
They were being exploited. Yeah.
They were being exploited.
It is exploitation.
And
if you're viewing somebody to view them as different, it's exploitative.
Right. But I think it's harder to make the case about that. It's hard to make that case for, say, like a person who is just like, oh, I'm the bearded lady. And they're just trying to make the case, but it is a lot easier to make the case when it's somebody who has like five arms and, you know what I mean? Like, they are forced to be there because society will not allow them to exist in any other way. Right. I don't know.
That's the far side of the bell curve, right? Like, I think that the thing about the uncanny valley is it's like, it is so close. Cause again, I think when you start to get into something that is that like that visually different or that psychologically different, you have the break. Like you have the suspension of belief, right? That this is no longer something that I can identify with.
See,
so it is now completely different, but it's not the other, right? It's not like a doppelganger. Like, I think a doppelganger is a really good way of kind of summing up the uncanny. Like a doppelganger is your mirror image, hypothetically, or it is something that psychologically mirrors you exactly. But that's the problem, or that's the difference.
Yeah.
But I think if you start to get into something that is if it kind of varies from that, that's where you're like, well, I don't like, I think again, then it's like the horror movies or it's like, you know, you have that, like, I think I can, your mind can get around it because it's that much different. Your mind can't get around the uncanny. That's why it shuts down.
See,
is my thought.
I wonder how much of it is societally driven. So what I mean by that is, like, when, you know, back in, say, the 40s and the 20s mm-hmm. and 30s and whatever, mm-hmm. when there were these kind of traveling sideshows, mm-hmm. it was really easy, I think, in that situation, in that society, to look at those people in those shows as being uncanny, as not deserving human empathy necessarily. And so being able to allow yourself to have that feeling of revulsion right away. Whereas I think in, say, today's mm-hmm. society, where, you know, thank God the kind of stigma and the healthcare and the, you know, the way that we treat other people, regardless of the way that they look or whatever, right? Whatever kind mm-hmm. of, you know, whatever kind of challenges they've been born with or, you know, whatever, that we look at people as equal because they are people. You know what I mean? And so, and that it's not 100% across the board, of course, right?
I don't know.
But
no,
still,
I would, yeah, I know you're not trying to argue. Yeah.
You know, I would argue
that we're blind, it's blind egalitarian society.
No, I
don't know. I think it's something different. Like, I do think it on the Venn diagram, it'll start to overlap that. But I think that this is something that exists. Like, I would argue psychologically, it is in everyone and you have some sort of reaction to it. Like, 1919 was when they put the words on it, right? And but even today, we're like, we see the cat video and we're like, whoa.
But what I'm,
no, T-Swift.
What I'm saying, though, and not to get too heavy with this, is that is the same sort of argument that was made about, say, you know, seeing like an interracial couple, right? That it was like, well, in the pit of your stomach, you get this feeling and it's, you know, it's natural to feel that way. And that's why it's wrong and whatever. I bet in a hundred years,
no,
we're going to have, like, I'm not even kidding, right? I'm not even kidding. Honestly, I bet in 100 years, the feeling that we are describing about robots will look weird and antiquated.
See, I disagree with you.
Because
100 years has passed since they were marionettes. I think that there's a difference between sort of a xenophobic behavior, and maybe this is more of like a symptom of something like the uncanny, but the uncanny can affect anybody, I think, is the thing. Is it's not necessarily geared by or informed by bias or an upbringing or a social thing that's that clear, or that is that sort of, I don't want to say cut and dry, but is that linear? I think it's more of an intangible construction of self and seeing and being able to kind of have that identity or that bearing and having something just not affect you enough that it throws it off.
I get you. What I would argue is, isn't society specifically there to curb our feelings like that? Right?
No.
Like, isn't that the point of society? To stop us from our animal instincts that make us make bad decisions that are selfish,
But then Freud would argue when they're sublimating that. That's where this uncanny comes from as well. Like,
true.
You cannot recognize what revulses you. You cannot recognize these, you know, the normal, like the socially appropriate reaction is revulsion. That's what you've been socialized into. But what is when you're looking at a doppelganger, what is that actually, what is that saying? It's saying something about you. It's saying something about yourself that is so uncomfortable, or if it's so foreign or so unhomelike, that it shuts, you have to have a different reaction to it.
See, I actually think at the root of all this, Marie, do you think
I love that, cats. I love
too.
Cats still.
I love cats so much.
I love cats.
Do you think that there are So by that same token, right? Do you think that there are like not extrinsic, but do you think that there are universal moral laws?
Dude, we were talking about a film trailer. We were talking about a film trailer, people. All right.
So listen, we can all agree. We can all agree the Cats trailer, hot garbage, scary, makes us uncomfortable. We don't know why.
Man, and I love, like, you know, singing in cars or carpool karaoke. Love it.
I just,
what is he doing in that, James?
You know what kind of pisses me off?
Here's the end. Really quick, the uncanny thing is hearing these poor people have to, like, defend it, too. And they talk about, really quick, like, digital fur technology is the term that they gave to the 3D fur that they had to put on them. So these actors didn't know that they were going to look like this until they saw the footage, right? So you want to talk about something uncanny. You're all like, you're all T-Swift, and you're all like, oh, I'm so excited. You guys, I love cats. I've just Instagrammed my cats today. I love them so much. And then you see these and you're like, what did you do to me? But you still have to be all like, I'm so honored. It's so exciting to be in this film.
What really annoys me about a lot of this is, so let's say like Rebel Wilson, right? Who plays the kind of, in every single movie, if there is a young woman character who is getting thrown out a window, you know it's played by Rebel Wilson.
Pretty much.
You know what I mean?
Pretty much.
Like, that is so...
Yep.
It must be so frustrating to be like, oh, cool, I'm going to be in Cats. What cat do I play? Oh, the one that gets her tail stuck in a mouse trap and flies out a window?
Yeah, cool. The kooky one.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, the kooky one who's doing having the physical comedy done with her body. Solid. Mm-hmm. Like... I can't understand. As soon as I saw that she was in the movie, I was like, there's going to be a cat that gets like, that falls off a cat tree or something. Like, she's going to fall into a vat of acid or, you know what I mean? Like, she's always getting physical comedy done to her. It was so, like.
I think that was what they cut from the Broadway was the acid. Was the acid
that was it? Was the cat vomiting off screen after the ingestion of the slightly toxic plant that it decided to eat?
No. They have, I think they said even like they have like them coughing up hairballs or pretending to cough up hairballs or something. Christ. And I was like, you can't be doing this, people.
It's just not like, necessary.
No, man, come on.
What's crazy too is what must be really frustrating too is they would have looked fine in wigs. You know what I mean? Like it would not have changed how much money the movie made, how much people liked it. It wouldn't have changed anything. Except for the fact that we are doing a podcast on it.
True.
And like other people are complaining, but we're the most important people in the universe, so.
Whatever. I'll give you that. I'll give you that. To me, I saw that and that was my immediate thought was like, gotta get on this. Gotta get on this and put this out to the people. This is crazy. Crazy stuff.
Good stuff, Marie.
So Marie, we're going to say two thumbs way up.
Two thumbs way up, two paws way up, or whatever scary half human, half cat appendage you have. This has been the Mad Scientist Podcast. It's been a fun one, Marie.
Meow.
Meow.
Meow. I can't even like, here's the other thing. It was like in like college, like everyone I knew was singing that song, the main song for Memories. All alone. And so you're like, oh God, that's the worst. Like Andrew Lloyd Webber's stuff is just, okay, sorry.
Yeah, it's schlock.
This
it's
has been
great.
A good one.
Well, this has been the Mad Scientist Podcast. Thank you to your listeners for listening. As always, I'm your host, Chris Cogswell, with my co-host, Marie Mayhew.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone. Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at madscientistpod or at teamgiantsquid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
Because we love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard.
Woohoo!
And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Califato, and I'm the creator of 7 Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.